Welcome one, welcome all, fellow workers. This is fellow worker Noah from the Industrial Workers of the World Tacoma Branch. And this is There Is Power in a Union by Joe Hill.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then join in the grand industrial band. Would you from misery and hunger be free? Then come do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working men when they stand, when they stand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. If you like sluggers to beat on your head, then don't organize, all unions despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. There is power in a band of working folk when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. Come all ye workers from every land, come join in the grand industrial band. Then we our share of this earth shall demand, come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folk when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand.
Greetings, listeners and fellow workers out in Radio Land. This is the broadcast of the Wobbly Radio Show. My name is fellow worker Gordon. I've been a member since 2008, and I'd like to introduce our fellow workers from around the table, and going to my right, fellow worker Lynn.
Hi, I'm Lynn, and I've been part of WOB Radio since, I think, the beginning, I'm not sure, about 3 or 4 years ago, and I enjoy it very much, and we have interesting roundtable discussions and presentations by our small but mighty FET force. So anyway, we have a great show for you again today, and we hope you're all listening, and get your friends to listen too.
Hello, everybody. My name is Marilyn, and I'm a retired mental health worker. I've been a member of the IWW since about 2006, 2008. I'm not good with numbers. And I go by she, they, and I really enjoy WOB Radio.
And my name is fellow worker Noah. I help do the production of this work as well as being a co-host. I'm the person who's here to clean up the episode, make it sound pretty for all of you listeners out there, as well as offer my thoughts and contributions. I've been a member of the Tacoma branch of the IWW since March of 2021, and as of March of this year, I am also the branch secretary. We, like fellow worker Lynn said, we have a lovely lineup of labor news, we have a book review coming up, we have a couple of roundtable discussions with our fellow workers assembled, so we hope that you can sit back, relax, and enjoy some edifying conversation.
And at that juncture, we're going to turn it over to fellow worker Marilyn, who's going to read some of our preamble to the Constitution for the Industrial Workers of the World.
That's right. This is our preamble in part. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all of the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of the workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions and the employing class aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Marilyn. Jumping into our labor news today, the Boeing firefighters and Boeing, the company, have reached a common agreement, and the lockout has officially ended for those of us who have been following the story. This article will be coming from Reuters. This article is also written by David Stepfordson. Boeing firefighters approve a new contract deal, and this was as of 2 days ago at time of recording. We were recording this on June the 1st. So to read off an excerpt from this article, Boeing firefighters voted on Thursday to approve a new 4-year contract deal that will boost wages for workers and end a weeks-long lockout by the plane maker. Boeing in early May locked out firefighters of the International Association of Firefighters, the IAFF, local I-66 in Washington State, after they rejected two contract offers in a move that drew the concern of President Joe Biden, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, and many members of Congress. Unionized firefighters voted 86-24 to approve the deal, and firefighters will return to work on Saturday. The 4-year deal includes a general wage hike of 2% to 3% annually, with guaranteed overtime increasing annual pay on average by up to $21,216, as well as a $1,000 signing bonus and other compensation improvements, according to a joint fact sheet from the company and the union reviewed by Reuters. The deal also includes job classification restructuring that allows more opportunities for promotion and will significantly reduce the time needed to get to top pay. So that is the conclusion, essentially, of the lockout of the Boeing firefighters that started in earlier May of this month. This has been a story that's been followed by many in organized labor because lockouts are something that occur a little bit more rarely nowadays compared to previous decades of union organizing, if I'm not mistaken, personally. This is a pretty cool labor story because lockouts by an employer can be very detrimental to workers because it often occurs with little to no notice. It immediately deprives workers of their wages, and even within the larger trade unions, strike funds tend not to be a huge slush fund of cash. They can actually run pretty thin. So the fact that the Boeing firefighters were willing to stick it out, and they received a massive amount of community solidarity as well. There were members from tens of other unions joining the picket lines to join with the Boeing firefighters.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
It's a pretty cool example of community solidarity and cross-union solidarity finally getting these firefighters the contract that they want with Boeing.
Well, Boeing doesn't have a lot to gain on a lot of things that it does these days. Their reputation is pretty much on the line. But imagine the PR for locking out the firefighters. It's like,
yeah.
What?
It did not help. Their public reputation, despite all the issues they've been having with constructing and oversight with safety on their planes, to then lock out your firefighters for a whole month.
It's a bad look.
No, it did not. Yeah.
And potentially really scary, dangerous.
Well,
catastrophic.
Well, as fellow worker Alan brought out on our last broadcast, those firefighters have to be on the site whenever any plane is fueled or defueled or any evolution that can involve, obviously, starting a fire. They have to be there. They have a lot more responsibility than people would understand normally. You think of a fire department and they're very reactive. They come out when there's a fire. But no, firefighters also serve a number of purposes for safety in our communities. We all are familiar with municipal fire departments, but some of these large industries and things like shipyards and things like railroads, they also have their own firefighters. And they're professionally trained and have to be certified by whatever state they're in. So these guys were the face, in my opinion, of safety for Boeing. And in the middle of their travails, having, you know, wheels fall off and door panels blow out, they were locking out their firefighters. So that was a pretty dumb move, in my opinion, but it also showed the mindset of the company.
Sure did.
Fellow worker Gordon, would you like to go ahead and talk about the recent campaign by the UAW at Mercedes?
Sure, I can do that. Recently there was an organizing drive from the United Auto Workers down in Tennessee. No, where was it? Alabama. To organize the Mercedes-Benz plant down there. And they failed. They came up short in union voting. And they had a little bit of a moment of trying to figure out why that happened. And here's a story by Mike Elk, who's a well-known labor writer. He publishes on many sites. I originally got it off the Portside site, which is good for, you know, aggregating news about labor.
Could you please repeat the author and the website one more time?
Sure. The author is Mike Elk, well-known labor writer, and I got it off of Portside, which is a good aggregating website. But Mike has his own newsletter, and he calls it the Payday Report. So if you want to look it up online, Payday Report, covering labor in news deserts. So what happened is that what they've done is that they had an election and lost. And their self-criticism was, and Mike says, my sense from talking to union leaders over the phone is that the digital heavy and organizing committee light approach made the UAW unable to withstand Mercedes' give us one more chance plea after they fired their plant manager. So what we're getting at here is that rather than using, and I'm heavily paraphrasing from the article, but rather than using traditional organizing committee structures, the UAW relied heavily on digital meetings, a light staff approach from the International Union, and getting workers to sign union cards via QR codes.
Yeah.
Well, this sounds very modern and very up-to-date, but and the reasoning behind that was given the positive media coverage of the UAW in the stand-up strike, which they won, many UAW leaders were confident they could win using this approach. And they even came into the election with 70% of people checking a card saying, yeah, they would vote union. And that's kind of a standard and kind of a traditional level before the union gets serious about organizing. If you ain't got 70%, they ain't going to back you up. The exception, of course, recently was the Amazon warehouse, who went out on a limb. The Amazon warehouse workers went out on a limb and they only had 30% or so, and they filed for an election and they won because they knew personally the high turnover in their outfit. Okay, so that's, what does that tell you? The workers know what's going on and the union leadership doesn't always. So they decided to go ahead. This is Chattanooga, that's when they won in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But the union, the UAW, lost 44% to 56% in Alabama, where the Mercedes plant is. And that's pretty bad, really. They lost by more than 10 points. So so they were wanting to know, because that's a lot of money to have an organizing campaign for a big outfit like that with thousands and thousands of workers. If we're organizing our local, you know, bake shop, that's like maybe 10 or 12 of us. But for a big outfit like Mercedes-Benz, thousands of workers in the South. So there's a spokesperson named Kirk Garner said the union was caught off guard as the company's anti-union meetings were very low-key backroom affairs and targeted specific departments. The company conducted psychological profiles of the workers and only invited persuadable, in air quotes, workers to anti-union meetings. So you see that really were pretty smart at targeting. Now, remember, Alabama is not known for, as a hotbed of union activity or any kind of progressive politics. And so, in my opinion, and in Mike Elk's opinion, apparently, the UAW was resting on its laurels with their success with the Big Three, and they took for granted that a lot of these newer, I'm not going to say new, but newer techniques for organizing electronically would save the day, but that's not what happened. So what the union, what the company did was actually plea with the workers. They fired the plant manager. Okay, see what we did? We fired the plant manager. Give us another chance. Unfortunately, the workers believed him, and they gave him another chance, and they lost their ability to have a union at this very important automobile plant. The thing is that a lot of foreign automobile workers, and the names are familiar, Fiat, Toyota, Mercedes, Volkswagen, they bought the bill of goods from governors and governments in the South that said, oh, we have very docile workers, and they're not going to demand much, and our wages are low, our taxes are low. Come to Alabama and build your cars. Well, they did. And what's happened is that we have an upside-down labor management situation in the South. Now, even with the UAW's recent victories, I think this was a slap in the face to their leadership to rethink some of these newfangled methods. What we found in IWW's experience is that one-on-one, dealing with the workers on the shop floor, personal contact, the real strength of the union comes from small work groups, people who know each other, people who work on the same portion of the line, people who work in the same restaurant, either front of the house or back of the house. You get the picture. You and your work buddies know the situation and know their strengths and weaknesses, and the big international union just sort of let that slide by. And unfortunately, the culture in a lot of the South is to assume that unions are not good for you. And we'll get into a little bit of that later. But the upshot of the deal is that at least the UAW leadership has taken it seriously that they made several mistakes. And so this is kind of like an after-action report, and what did we do wrong? And they're trying to be honest with each other and with their rank and file, which is a good attitude. I have to say that I admire it. However, if they would have just trusted the old-fashioned methods of dealing with people as individuals, dealing with the influential people who are in the shop, they might have succeeded. But they vow to keep on working, and they're going to have another election in maybe a year or two, and we'll see how that works out.
It's pretty interesting that the UAW, like you mentioned, they were trying a different array of organizing tactics, like having these specific meetings focusing on specific job departments. They were using QR codes instead of what you emphasize with one-on-one conversations mm-hmm. with their fellow workers, which I think does a lot better of a job of making the relationships with the coworkers that you want to have.
Right.
It's more direct. It has a human face attached to it. And this is something that we've talked about in our union as well. Technological advancements are great, but sometimes the old formula still works when it comes to having those conversations with mm-hmm. your coworkers. Forming a steering committee outside of work that focuses on all the job department's concerns and not just this job department has these concerns, that job department has those concerns.
Greetings, fellow workers and listeners in Radioland. This is the time in our broadcast where we do a book review. So since I'm tasked with doing it for this episode, the book I've chosen is called Solidarity Unionism, Rebuilding the Labor Movement from Below. And the book is written by the late Staunton Lind. He just passed away a year and a half ago or so. He was 92 years old, and he had done a tremendous amount of great work and journalistic writing about the labor movement, especially in what we now refer to as the Rust Belt. And he worked out of Youngstown, Ohio, with his wife of who knows how many decades, whom he met, you know, going to college. Now, Staunton Lind is an academic, or was an academic, and he had a lot of influence from Marxist schools of thought, but he came to understand that that didn't always work, to have, you know, trained academics with no contact with the actual people on the line, or, you know, either on the assembly line or down in the mine or in the steelworks. So he literally set out, he and his wife set out to what in another book he called a company or accompaniment, being Marxist scholars with a lot of education, but definitely getting input from the actual people on the line who were doing the work. And he had a lot of great success with this, especially in Youngstown. So if you're wondering, solidarity unionism, what is that? Well, we think we know what solidarity is. And some people, you know, theorize about it. But solidarity means caring for each other, caring for each other's families, caring for other workers in other towns or in maybe other industries, and beginning to get a glimpse of a consciousness that can go all over the world. And as a matter of fact, even in the introduction, the guy doing the introduction is named Ness. He said, "The thesis of this book is that it is possible to have a strong and lasting unions based on rank-and-file solidarity. We must look to examples drawn from the industrial workers of the world and solidarity unions in the global South." So, the guy right in the introduction briefly introduces India and parts of Africa, and to say that the workers in these countries are treated just orders of magnitude worse than workers in North America or Europe or anywhere else, and they really are exploited, sometimes ridiculously so, up to and including near slavery. So he outlines what these workers did, which is to create their own parallel organizations. He uses that term pretty frequently to show that, well, after the apartheid government in South Africa was overthrown, guess what happened? The National Union of Mine Workers and a couple of other big unions that were very active in the anti-apartheid struggle started to turn reactionary and conservative because they had power. And so what happened is that they began to work very closely with the employers, and even to the point of hiring security guards who actually had a massacre. The Marikana massacre occurred on August 16, 2012. Okay, so this is a while after apartheid fell. And, something like 34 workers and were killed and 78 were injured and wounded from the South African police, which is pretty crazy because the last time that happened was, you know, in Soweto or someplace like that, you know, where they massacred a lot of Africans, where the police were, you know, an organ of the apartheid state and mostly white. But nowadays, that's not true. And yet, 38 workers got shot to death, another 78 grievously injured. And so you say, well, what, you know, he did this by way of saying, what does this all mean? And so he introduces the book by Staunton Lind by saying that Solidarity Unionism is a timeless book that warns us that if we rely on competent, smart professionals to run our union movement, it will lead to ruin. And that's pretty bold statement. So let me give you a little background, not to take too much more time, but Staunton Lind wrote this as a lecture in 1992, and then he came out with the second edition years later, and that's what I'm reading. I'm reading the second edition with illustrations by Mike Konopacki, who also illustrated Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. And here's the guy's name. With an introduction by Emmanuel Ness. And this was published in 2014. and you can get it on PM Press, one of the press outlets that we like to source material from. So Staunton Lind gets into, firstly, gives you background about the town of Youngstown, which was a very big, important industrial center in America, steel town. And what happened is that after World War II, capital lobbied for and received a lot of laws and legislation all over the world, by the way, not just in the United States, that loosened up regulations about how they treat workers, loosened up how the mobility of capital. And so that entire industries could say, well, these workers are just charging us too much for their labor. They have too much power. We're going to move to another country. They'll move to Mexico. They'll move to Africa. They'll move to all over the world where they can get cheap labor, and thereby ruining entire swaths of the country who depend on heavy industry. Back in the, and any of us who worked back in the 1990s in industrial work realized that this was happening. And they were farming out all this work to foreign companies. That's because they were allowed to do so. So the other thing that Staunton Lind gets into, which was a little bit surprising, is that he claims that the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, with luminaries like John L. Lewis and others, actually baked into their CIO contracts this whole idea of contractualism and ending up being the police force for capital. He said the CIO, and I had different views of it, and I've read this book before, but I got a lot more out of it this time around because it disabused me of the notion that the CIO was always progressive. It was not. And so the upshot of the deal, he compares some of the labor reform outfits that came along in the after the 1970s, and he compares it to Polish Solidarity. You remember the Solidarność movement with Lech Walesa, and how that started actually with a couple of women, a woman named Anna Valentinovich was fired from her job as a crane operator and the Lenin shipyard. This is what kills me, in the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk, Poland, in August of 1980, and the whole shipyard went out to get her reinstated, and she had a friend named Alina Pienskovas, and she was described as a tiny woman who could get up on a barrel and lecture people with a big voice right there on the shipyard in Gdansk. And so that was pivotal. These two women, which I like to emphasize, were pivotal in organizing that shipyard. And all throughout the book, I have to say, and he jumps back and forth different examples at different times in America and in other places in the world, that he said that, okay, he's describing the Allegheny Congenial Industrial Union. This was a parallel outfit because the steel workers and the mine workers and all those traditional unions were not responding to worker demands. So he said, this organization copied the IWW by devoting itself to struggles around demands rather than negotiating contracts. But it also used a system of departmental delegates inside the plant as its basic structure. So, hearkening back to the last news article we were checking out about the UAW coming to the realization that maybe all this modern newfangled organizing techniques with QR codes and stuff, maybe that's not the best thing. Although, we definitely want to include that aspect since many more people are digitally literate. But what he's saying, go back to the old-fashioned methods, you know, one-on-ones and talking to people in small groups, because some of the worker intellectuals, I'll use a very old-fashioned expression from my, you know, Marxist days, but worker intellectuals are natural leaders, self-taught. And he mentioned several of them, which is, you know, like Marty Glaberman and Ed Mann and people like that, that the reader will find interesting. As to the ease of the book to read, it's very easy. It's written in a very easy style that average people can understand. It's full of references and full of notes that can lead you to further reading and understanding. And I highly recommend it for people who are looking for a way to organize their workplace and are finding a little bit of difficulty with large traditional unions, as we've discussed. My final point is that we have discussed before that if a large union, we discussed the United Farm Workers and how the United Farm Workers did not want to represent the flower pickers and the strawberry pickers up there in Bellingham and Mount Vernon because they wouldn't have gotten enough union cards out of it. So they just let them by the wayside. They organized themselves. And IWW was part of that too. There's a lot of people in IWW up there that helped make that possible. So the whole point is solidarity unionism is our hope for the future. And it basically means that you don't have to actually be in the same plant or in the same union. If you've got other unions in town that are going out on strike, or there's a million ways that the average workers can assist them without violating any kind of current labor law under Taft-Hartley. So I highly recommend, and Staunton Lynn, like I said, only recently passed, was a real soldier for, he gave up his academic life. He could have been, you know, a college professor, tenured, you know, at Yale, you know, forever, and his wife also, but they both decided as a couple that they were going to accompany the working class, write honestly about them, to give advice to workers all over the world. And so I highly recommend the book. You can get it from PM Press, and you can probably get it through the IWW store. But try PM Press, and I recommend it to anybody who's looking for examples from the past and hope for the future about organizing at work.
That was really interesting. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about the IWW tradition of not using acronyms to actually say out what the letters stand for, and also the tradition of not using academic jargon when they're speaking.
That's right. And it was partially because the IWW had a lot of very educated people in it, and self-educated, okay, mostly men, but women played a very important role in the IWW's, you know, union halls and educational resources. And we were the first union to actually embrace minorities and women as leaders. And it's a great example, and they keep hearkening back to it. And we find, even with the UAW, which used to be a CIO union, used to be pretty tough, right? They're saying the IWW had the right idea. So shout out to us. But the whole point is that, and he stresses this in the book, an injury to one is an injury to all. It's one of our old slogans. And he means it in this respect. And he draws dozens of examples from labor struggles in the United States, Canada, and all over the world. So get the book, read up.
I think that the other aspect that the book really touched on as well is that and this is also a lesson that the UAW is currently learning right now due to their failure down at Alabama at that Mercedes plant, is that the basis of unionism, how it starts in the shop and how it radiates out to the rest of the community, is human face-to-face relationships.
That's it.
I don't disagree with the UAW doing Zoom meetings and QR codes. It's an accessibility thing, and I think that for some people that might allow them better access to signing on to the union or learning more about the union. To drive the point home, it can't be the primary strategy, and it certainly can't be the only strategy.
They're tools in the toolbox.
And some of those older tools, especially the things like we've mentioned, like one-on-one conversations with your coworkers, actually having relationships with your coworkers. I mean, you stand next to these people for hours on end, day after day, month after month, year after year. You know, if you can't at least have a conversation with them, then you're not going to be able to start building that solidarity that will eventually lead to a union. You have to know these people, and you have to care about them, too, which I think this also brings home this book in a lot of different examples, is that they also had community relations outside of the union hall.
They did.
I'm going to order that book.
Yeah, you can get it from PM.
Yeah.
And we might even think about getting a few copies just for our literature stash. But he really, really emphasized the fact that not just these one-on-ones, not just the, you know, people-to-people, but especially parallel labor organizations. That mm-hmm. means
yeah.
that if your union is not responding to your complaints, and they're very undemocratic, the way unions are structured, really mm-hmm. undemocratic. You get your grievances dropped if they don't think they're worth fighting.
The way some unions are structured are okay. undemocratic. There are other organs of unionism that are more democratic.
I'll give you that.
I hate
that.
To nitpick, but I just want to put that out there.
Still, you put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. But anyway, yes, fellow worker Noah's correct. There are, and especially now, there are movements afoot within our traditional unions that want to democratize it, that want more response to the needs of the workers.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, I think this book is a really great example of how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
One more time, could you please read off the title and where you can get it?
Sure. The title is Solidarity Unionism, Rebuilding the Labor Movement from Below. And it's by an author named Staunton Lind. And I'll spell that, S-T-A-U-G-H-T-O-N. Staunton and Lind, L-Y-N-D, and his wife, Alice Lind, who wrote her own books and did most of the editing for the couple. So you can get that from PM Press, second edition, which was put out in 2014, I believe.
Now, it looks like, coming up on the radio show here, we also wanted to give a brief report about what our Monument Committee in the union has been up to. And if you don't mind me introducing the Monument Committee, fellow worker Gordon.
Go ahead.
So the Monument Committee is a committee that has recently formed in the industrial workers of the world on a national level, if I'm not mistaken, to basically track down the histories and the lives and the final resting places of union workers in the IWW all around the country. As you can imagine, you know, our union dates back to 1905. A lot of these grave sites or memorial sites might be underkempt. They might be, you know, literally lost to the sands of time, or sometimes are just improperly marked. So the Monument Committee has been doing fantastic work in tracking down these fellow workers, their surviving descendants, and their final resting places so that they can get the recognition and even the tombstones that they deserve. Fellow worker Gordon, could you maybe talk a little bit about what's been going on with them?
Sure thing. Down in Centralia, as many of the listeners might know, but if you don't know, on the first Armistice Day in 1919, during a parade, the American Legion detachment decided that they were going to attack the Wobbly Hall, the IWW Hall on Tower Street in Centralia. And what happened is that, naturally, they stormed the hall, and the Wobblies' attorney, Elmer Smith, said that it was completely within their rights to defend the hall. So they did. As a result, four American Legionnaires got shot to death, and one Wobbly was taken out of, you know, after they arrested him, they chased him, and they got him, and they put him in jail. Well, he was broken out of jail in the middle of the night and taken out in the woods and roughed up, and they lynched him. They hung him off a bridge over the Skookumchuck River. And shortly thereafter, they put up a monument. They started calling this episode the Centralia Massacre, meaning that these poor legionnaires, these innocent guys, were murdered by these commie radical Wobblies. And so what happened is that a sham trial ensued, and maybe a dozen of IWW members were imprisoned on a trumped-up murder charge, and a lot of them stayed in jail for over a decade.
Also, their lawyer who was representing them during this trial was also disbarred for right. trying to represent them.
Right, he couldn't practice law after that. They had a change of venue to Montesano, which is not much better than Centralia in that regard. And anyway, these workers spent a long time in jail. One of them went crazy. One of them died as a result of being imprisoned without proper medical care. Boy, does that ring a bell today. And so we wanted to set the record straight. So it's been ongoing for years that we wanted to have, the IWW that is, wanted to have a monument right near the big monument they put up to these courageous American Legionnaires. I said courageous in quotes, of course. And so we finally got permission from the city of Centralia to do so. So we made a plaque out of bronze with the names of all the Wobblies who got incarcerated. And that's going to be set in a stone, and which is pretty huge. It's going to be like 6,000-pound stone coming from, ironically, Vietnam, which is, a good place to get marble. But anyway, what happened yesterday was that we constructed a concrete base per code, the Centralia City Council. And the good part of that, so you have to have a concrete base upon which to put the stone, in which to set the plaque, right? So a couple of the guys from the laborers union, LIUNA, came out, volunteered their time. LIUNA volunteered the concrete, and they mixed and poured a concrete foundation by hand.
Could you please describe who LIUNA is again?
Sure. It's Labor International Union North America. And they're people who do, construction work and, utility work and things like that. And, I promised to give the guys a shout out. It was Jeremy and Richie, from the Laborers Union. And they stressed that it was Local 252, okay? They wanted me to get that straight because they're the second biggest in the state. So they wanted to show that they work harder. So anyway, they did. I had to leave around 2:30, 2:45, but they had already finished mixing by hand and pouring this reinforced slab with a couple of Wobblies standing around ostensibly helping, but really just schmoozing. But anyway, it was a wonderful example of union solidarity, and I really appreciate Laborers Union International, Local 252. For donating their time and materials to help rectify this historical wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I've been down to Wesley Everett's grave in previous memorials. We gather down there every year on November 11th to commemorate his passing and what happened to the other Wobblies as well. And by we, I mean other IWW locals here in Washington State, from Oregon, and also just Wobblies at large. Mm-hmm. The Monument Committee, as fellow worker Gordon has also previously mentioned, is also trying to look for other Wobbly grave sites and other potential memorials in the future for strike actions where violence occurred, where Wobblies passed away. Sometimes just finding the gravestones of Wobblies that have just been kind of mismarked or lost to time. They've been doing a lot of great work, especially in Centralia, though. I remember testifying in front of City Hall, Centralia City Hall, in fact, a couple of years ago, to try and argue in favor of it. I'm not exactly great at speaking in public, especially in front of a group of elected officials. So if anyone was there and listened to me talk, please forget that. But I actually made a speech talking more about the Centralia tragedy than I did about the importance of making a memorial. So that was kind of embarrassing. But long story short, the city council approved this monument unanimously, which was pretty surprising considering the reputation that the IWW has had in that area, even up to this day.
Up till now, it's true.
Especially considering some of the other far-right activities that have been taking place in that particular county as well.
Indeed, and as an adjunct remark to this monument, which is in the process of getting set up, apparently the stone is still aboard a ship somewhere in the Pacific. It'll get here. There's also a movement that got tragically cut short when the principal attorneys that were working for us, they were also IWW members, both of them became very gravely ill and passed away, two separate incidents. But what they were trying to do is start a campaign to get these Wobblies, and several of them, I want to say like around 9 or 10, exonerated by the governor of the state of Washington. So that's a whole new kettle of fish to watch boil. But I think that would be a great thing, especially if Governor Inslee can do this before he leaves office. It would be a wonderful thing to exonerate the names because it was well noted after years and years after the trial that it was a sham trial. You know, it was heavily in favor of the prosecution. It was during the Red Scare of 1919-1920. So, yeah, there's a movement afoot to get the Wobblies exonerated officially. And we'll fill you in as that develops.
All right. So coming up to our roundtable here, we know that this episode will be coming out for June. So for this roundtable that we have coming up for this episode, we're going to be talking about Pride Month as it is now June. We want to touch on remembering radical queer and trans history of protest, talk a little bit about the corporatization of Pride and how organized labor and labor unions have been a part of queer and trans history. I've been going down a bit of a rabbit hole on this. For our next month's book review, there's a book that I've been reading that really touches a lot on how early queer activism and trans activism from 1900 up until 1960 really did incorporate elements of the political left wing. A lot of queer and trans people found a home in the political left wing, for example, within socialist and communist parties and within labor unions as well, even though those organizations were not outright accepting of them or even kind right. of looked down on them a little bit. For example, there were some socialist or communist groups that, you know, treated queer and trans people like, you know, cosmopolitans, you know, suffering from cosmopolitanism of dabbling in bourgeois culture and behavior, for example. But queer and trans people still found a home in the political left wing, and especially for today's episode, in labor unions. One of those early queer icons is actually somebody from the IWW, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. She was a longtime organizer and one of the most preeminent members of the IWW during our early years of activity in the early 1900s. She had a longtime quote-unquote female friend who lived with her for many, many years that up until relatively recently people had only suspected was her romantic partner, although she was previously married to a man before she met her. Let me actually pull up that book really quickly because I want our fellow listeners to get a chance to read this book before we report on it. This book that I'm currently reading that I hope to present next month is called Love's Next Meeting, The Forgotten History of Homosexuality and the Left in American Culture. This is a pretty interesting book by Aaron S. Lecklider. That's Lecklider. Like I said earlier, it talks about how queer people and trans people are involved in things like labor organizing, organizing during the Great Depression, sympathizing with the pre-war Soviet Union, contributing to the Republican effort in the Spanish Civil War, opposing police and state harassment and racial discrimination. And so they really aligned themselves with other classes of the dispossessed in the United States in the early half of the 20th century. And this, of course, all taking place well before Stonewall. And one of the big takeaways of the book was that kind of intermingling of queer and trans people with the political left and with labor unions really helped develop the early queer and trans civil rights movement before Stonewall. A lot of those people that were a part of those organizations later drifted into early forms of like the Mattachine Society or the Daughters of Litibus, if I got the name correctly, and also contributed to queer and trans activism moving into the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s. So it's a pretty fascinating read, and it kind of touches how, it really touches on how queer and trans people were socially and economically dispossessed like a lot of other classes in the U.S. were, and how they found a common relationship with each other in struggling against those things, whether that was trying to form a union, whether that was fighting, you know, organized racial discrimination, especially in the South, whether that was contributing to socialist, communist, and anarchist organizations at a time when even a lot of those organizations, they stressed free love in the sense that, you know, contraception should be available and people should be able to form relationships with or without a marriage, but it was still not as very openly pro-queer or pro-trans. There are definitely elements of queer and trans people interacting with the political left, for example, in Europe, who got to be more open before the rise of the Nazis and fascism in the 1930s and 40s. There's something else I wanted to touch upon for Pride Month as well that I feel will resonate with a lot of our listeners. Something that I have noticed whenever I go to Pride parades or Pride celebrations you know, events like that, is that there is this reemergence of a consciousness about how much corporations try to co-opt social and cultural movements for change. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to any pride parade, it's essentially a list of corporate donors for the pride organizers or the organization that organizes those kinds of pride events. Well, at the last pride that I went to in Seattle, I actually got to participate in the parade. And the people who were leading the parade was the SEIU with the Starbucks Workers Union. There was this pretty big shift of, we recognize that there are companies that want to uplift queer and trans people in terms of their messaging or their marketing or their attempt to appeal to queer and trans consumers. But there's been this shift in mindset of, well, here are these groups of queer and trans workers who are trying to unionize in their workplace, and they're being shot down and stonewalled by these companies that are also trying to market themselves towards those same people. There's this contradiction of class going on. Who could have predicted this? Marx wrote an entire book series on this, but we'll review his work later. But I think that it's very interesting that this rebirth of radical queer and trans thought and consciousness is coming back into a lot of these spaces. And it's even taking place at these large organized events like Pride. Hmm. I sincerely hope that Seattle Pride gets to do something like that again, hopefully coming up later this month. I'm looking forward to attending Seattle Pride again. But especially as a queer person myself, I, fellow worker Noah, I have really seen how the political left and union circles have really tried to stress the fact that queer and trans people often don't earn a lot of the same wages that right. a lot of other classes of working folk do, that there is a space for queer and trans people within labor activism, social change, economic change, fighting discrimination, racism, all of these social ills that naturally pour out of capitalism wherever it pops its head. And I think that especially in the IWW, I've kind of found a home here because we do recognize how socioeconomic class is very much tied to how marginalized you are. Poor white workers might make higher wages than poor black workers, but at the end of the day, they're still being exploited by the same capitalists who want to keep their wages down. And this is something that the early IWW really stressed, was that black workers and white workers, they don't suffer the same way because racism works specifically against one group to pit the other group against them. But the IWW pushed back against that and said, actually, no, if immigrant workers and poor white workers and poor black workers and indigenous workers, if we all band together as a class, specifically of the working class, we have a much stronger capacity for solidarity and change. And I think that is partially why I became inspired to become an IWW member all the way back in March of 2021, was because this is a union that recognizes that disparity, that there are intersectional facets of oppression, even along class lines, and that we should band together to fight back against it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And I spent my entire working life in what used to be considered in the industrial environment, okay? We talk about the industrial workers of the world, but we're talking about organizing by industry. What I'm talking about is that I worked for 31 years in the naval shipyard in Bremerton, and it was an extremely toxic male environment. It was almost like you had to have a misogynistic attitude and an anti-gay and lesbian attitude just to have credibility with your fellow workers. And I began to see that change as more and more people realized that they had family members that were gay or lesbian. They had people that they enjoyed working with that they found out were gay and lesbian. And why should that change a good working and relationship? And so after 31 years of a toxic masculine environment, I began to see the glimmers of, shall I say, tolerance, or at least, you know, giving people an even break. So that's a sea change. That's definitely a sea change. You don't find that in your traditionally male and traditionally, you know, hard-working macho type trades, right? So I'm hoping for, you know, I haven't been on the waterfront in 15 years. I'm long retired. But I was beginning to see, especially from some of my fellow workers who were, you know, had family members that were gay or lesbian, that this attitude began to change. And that harkens back to solidarity unionism also, because it means, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. So if my cousin or my sister or a brother or nephew or grandchild is experiencing oppression because of their sexual orientation, that's wrong. And it's just as wrong as a fellow worker experiencing alienation or oppression because he happens to be a person or she happens to be a person of color.
Absolutely. There is a article that I'm pulling up here. This is by the magazine called The Nation. This was written back in 2022, called Queering the Labor Movement, talking about how unions should draw lessons from queer activism about how to sustainably, even joyfully, build power. And this is written by Anne Belay. And she talks about how larger trade unions like the SEIU, especially, who work in service work, have done a lot of really good work allowing queer and trans people to lead labor organizing, to address specific issues related to queer and trans workers in their workplaces, and how there's this, specifically this overlap with how queer and trans organizing has occurred in the past and the present, and how that has a relationship with how union organizing occurs in the past and present. It both involves, like we've talked about previously in the radio show, it involves a lot of face-to-face or community-to-community engagement, forming our own communities of people who want to work on common projects to address the forms of discrimination or the forms of suffering that we face in this world. You know, what are the most direct ways to address that? It kind of reminds me, you know, we talk a lot in the IWW about direct action, things like marching on the boss, slowing down, sitting down. A lot of queer activism also did the same thing in the 80s and 90s mm-hmm. around the AIDS epidemic in America. You know, there were queer activists who were participating in die-ins in front of hospitals, in front of the FDA for refusing to clear drugs that were being produced for or experimented on specifically for HIV and AIDS. There is also, and this is a reference to a Philosophy Tube video that I watched a while back on YouTube, the way that queer people organize to change how medical companies and hospitals test drugs.
Oh.
Because at the time, they were essentially using queer and trans people who were dying of AIDS as guinea pigs for some of these drug trials. So when queer and trans people were like, oh, I'm in this, you know, placebo trial to figure out which drug works, this one's definitely working for me, I'm just going to give this out to my friends. And it would skew the results of these research studies because they're we don't want to die. If I think I have something that works, I'm going to give it to the people that I care about.
That harkens directly back in history to the 1930s when black men were experimented on for syphilis. Syphilis drugs, right? And how cruel can that be that, you know, half the group gets a placebo, a sugar pill, and the other half of the group is getting treated for a deadly social disease, syphilis, you know, which can affect children, which can, you know. And so these guys were being used as human guinea pigs. And of course, it came out later, too late for many of them. But what you're saying about what happened in the 80s directly harkens back to that.
Mm-hmm. And to keep quoting this article from The Nation, one of the things that the labor movement, to quote the article directly, the labor movement has always drawn power from queer activism, as Kim Kelly reminds us, particularly tactics for turning stigma into pride. Labor must develop such community-based organizing strategies to replace our reliance on individual leaders. That also really harmonizes within the IWW, which tries to be as horizontal and democratic as possible.
Yep.
We're not trying to empower, as you said before, a certain class of intellectuals or professors or, you know, organizers to lead an entire campaign. We want people to be actively contributing to what the face of that campaign is going to look like, what the strategies we can incorporate looks like.
And despite what people might think, you know, gay and lesbian people have been part of humanity since humanity began. And a significant portion of our fellow workers and brothers and sisters are gay or lesbian. And it's only just from a strictly pragmatic view, without even, you know, taking the moral high ground, is that We need these folks. We need these folks to help organize. And we have to be able to tolerate each other and actually embrace and love one another.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH. Right. And like I said earlier, a lot of the tactics and strategies that are being used, that have been used by queer and trans organizers of the past, have translated into how unions conduct their organizing campaigns today. Specifically in things like, you know, sit downs, slow downs, going on, you know, strikes, even if they aren't, you know, strikes officially called out by a union, you know, or boycotts, things like that.
Direct action gets the goods.
Exactly. Direct action gets the goods, and that's something that both groups of activism have definitely relied upon in the past, and still rely upon in the present as well. I think it's...
Another observation from my experience.
Go ahead.
I talked just prior about a toxic masculine environment and how, you know, people would not even want to be associated with a gay person or a lesbian person simply because they feared social repercussions. Well, those days are over, I think, and we should definitely learn how to reach out and tolerate and help each other out. So that's just we can't win without everybody.
Yes, fellow worker Lynn.
Do you feel that way, that's in the past, that people are not afraid to, they're embarrassed by being in front of gay people?
I'm going to say that while acceptance rates for queer and trans people have definitely gone up over the past couple decades, I'm going to push back a little bit and say that the stigma definitely remains. As we've talked about on this radio show, you know, it's very hard to organize a union in the South. It's also very hard to be openly queer or trans in the South.
Yeah, that's a fact.
And other parts of the country as well. I've talked about this with other queer and trans people that I know in my life, you know, who have been social workers or union organizers, and they're like, yeah, no, 30 minutes out of Tacoma, it might as well be a red state. Mm. We like to pretend that because we're a blue state and we have these very progressive laws and policies regarding, say, labor organizing, that therefore the whole state is able to share in that power, when in reality it tends to be still pretty isolated to a lot of urban areas where there's a larger queer and trans community.
Right.
So I mean, I definitely think that the stigma and especially the danger remains, especially with the growth of the anti-trans movement over the past few years.
Well, a resurgence of what do they call it, blowback or a reaction.
Reactionary thought, yeah. I mean, I'm gonna say no, things are still pretty bad, but things have gotten better, and I will say that the way that queer and trans people have combated stigma by making themselves so open, by making themselves so apologetic, by making themselves as visible as possible and having their demands, like we've mentioned previous, as visible as possible and also as actionable as possible as well.
Right.
Is also something the labor unions of this country could especially build upon.
Definitely.
I'd like to touch on the stigma part a bit as well, because even though labor unions have gotten a lot of positive press, the majority of Americans support labor unions or would be happy to have one in their own workplace, positive sentiment does not equal action. This is the same thing that we're seeing with protests around what's going on in the Gaza Strip right now as a result of, you know, Israeli militarism trying to take over the Gaza Strip under the guise of hunting down Hamas. Just because that there is a public sentiment in favor of Palestinians doesn't mean that there is going to be some kind of action within the echelons of power, whether that's the government or capital or whatever, to actually change what policies they have in place. I think that there is still a stigma around labor unions because, and it kind of does have a parallel to queer and trans stigma, because the way that we fought that stigma, like I said, was being as open and as visible as possible. I think that one thing that the labor unions do suffer from is not being as outspoken as they possibly can. Mm. We have to find labor-related news specifically from labor-related news sites, especially for this radio show a lot of the time.
Right.
We're not as out and proud as unionists as we possibly can be, which is why I really liked what Seattle Pride did last year, was by literally putting the union people to the front of the parade, leading everything forward, even in front of all of their, you know, corporate sponsors that they had.
Wow.
So I think that's something that the current labor movement in this country should learn, should take to heart at least, is something that Woody Guthrie said all the way back in the 30s. Talk union wherever you can, whether it's in the home with your partner and your kids, whether that's with your coworkers, whether that's at City Hall, whether that's just out in the open. Talk union everywhere. Talk union around the world. Don't let that word leave your mouth. Spread the message wherever you can. I think that's something that the labor union can especially take to heart. And I think that that's something that a lot of the queer and trans workers in those unions have really tried to apply.
And good on them too, because, you know, talking about that toxic masculine environment, mm-hmm. A lot of guys didn't particularly want to participate in it. You know, it made them feel uneasy. It was almost like it was a theatrical thing, that since we worked in a certain trade, like, okay, you get a picture in your head, construction worker, big burly guy, you know, hard drinking, tough guy.
The peak of American masculinity, yeah.
Right, but 1 in 10 of those construction workers is going to be gay or lesbian, right?
Exactly.
And so I completely understand the unions, our union's always been up in front, but unions should take a better stand.
I think another piece of really interesting labor history that our fellow listeners should also take a look at was the British miners' strike in the early 80s.
Yeah.
There were a lot of gay and lesbian and transgender organizations that backed up those miners, even though those miners came from more conservative parts of the country.
Yes, that was the movie Pride.
Yes.
That was an excellent film.
Please watch the movie Pride about the union miners' strike and how queer and trans organizers came to back them up. Even though that strike ultimately failed, despite hundreds of thousands of people participating in it, there was this big movement within queer and trans communities to be like, even though these miners might be really socially, culturally, maybe even religiously conservative about how they feel about us, even if they aren't super welcoming to us, you know, they are suffering. This is something that we should be involved in, because if it happened, what's happening to them has happened to us before.
Right.
The ostracism, the being, you know, beaten by the police and arrested, yep, in mass numbers, you know, being harassed and spied on by our employers. This is what's happening to them, and we should back them up, even if they aren't as immediately accepting of us. And there was a huge relationship between the British... There was a growth in that relationship between the British miners and those queer and trans activists who really came to back them up.
More acceptance. Yes. Definitely more social acceptance and appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Just appreciation. Hey, you don't have to come out here and walk a picket line with us, but you did. And you helped us, you know, cook meals for our members on strike. You guys and gals helped us out. And that's a simple... It might sound transactional, but it isn't. It's solidarity. That's
exactly
what it is.
Yeah, it's a fantastic case of solidarity between two organizations that don't seem like they would have a natural relationship with each other.
Right.
Even though they had experienced, you know, a lot of the same, like I said, harassment by the police, arrests, stigma against them by,
yeah,
more conservative elements of the country. It's a fascinating story, so please watch the movie Pride about the British miner strike and how queer and trans people came to help them. It's a fantastic illustration of the kinds of relationships that we're talking about now.
About what year did that come out?
Oh, geez, about 20 years ago, maybe?
The movie Pride?
Yeah.
No, it only came out a few years ago. I can actually look it up really quick.
Well, it's about the 80s, so I'm perhaps misconstrued that. But yeah, you can go on IMDb and find out.
Yeah, actually. Hold on, let me pull it up. The movie came out in 2014.
Whoa.
It's a comedy drama based on a true story about how a group of gay and lesbian activists raised money and support for the striking miners in 1984.
Yep.
I saw that at the Grand Cinema.
Yeah. I have yet to watch it myself. But I guess if there's anything else that I can say for Pride Month, is that most queer and trans people are working class. They're already a part of your workplace. They're already a part of your community. Many of them are already there in your labor hall or in your union. And a lot of them are doing the kind of activism and organizing that is necessary for the labor movement to continue, as well as addressing specifically the needs and demands of queer and trans workers as well. As I hope that I've illustrated previously, there is an overlap between queer and trans communities and the labor movement. It literally goes back within the entire past century of labor organizing, even if it wasn't exactly as out and proud as it is now.
Yep.
I think to queer and trans workers out there who do remain unorganized, find another place that you can find a home is the union hall. And even though there are conservative elements within unionism, especially within working class, amongst a lot of the workers that might be members of certain trades, I think that that sentiment, that anti-queer, anti-trans sentiment, can be broken by the kind of solidarity work that we've talked about, for example, with the British miners' strike. Mm-hmm. Show up to the picket line, participate in the organizing. You know, a way of combating stigma is helping alleviate the problems that we all face, whether that's poor wages, hours, working conditions. Offer your support, because even if it isn't a queer-branded form of activism, it does help queer and trans people to be organized and to get those protections in the workplace and to get better wages. So, I mean, I've certainly found my home here in the IWW. If you're interested, I can sign you on if you want to get involved. But yeah, fellow worker Lynn.
Are you aware of any upcoming events in Tacoma, Pierce County, specifically for Pride Month?
Seattle Pride is going to be taking place on the last weekend of this month here in June. That's the weekend of the 28th through the 1st. That's Friday the 28th through Monday the 1st. They have a whole bunch of different Pride activities that are going on. Tacoma Pride is going to be next month in July, specifically the weekend of the 13th and the 14th. There's a whole bunch of different events that you can look up online that are taking place during those weekends, both in Seattle and here in Tacoma. The Tacoma IWW is hoping to table at Tacoma Pride. We're still currently waiting on the lottery system that the Pride organizers have set up for people who want to booth to get back to us as to whether or not we have a spot. We'll definitely try and make a public announcement if we do get a tabling spot as to where we're going to be and at what times we're going to be available. We're going to have a couple of delegates out. We're going to have a fun little game, hopefully, that we can set up for the people who are visiting the Pride Parade. Some activities for children as well that we're also trying to organize. And yeah, if you're interested in getting signed on to a union that is explicitly pro-queer and pro-trans and that definitely welcomes and accepts the involvement of those who want to get organized in the labor movement, the IWW is a good home for you, fellow workers. It is a good place to leave off on the fact that I've worked in blue-collar working-class conditions for most of my working life. Not all of my coworkers were terribly accepting of people like me or other people like me. Yeah. I've definitely faced harassment and slurs in the workplace before, and I still have to say that I don't know, it's tough. It's tough. I'm not going to say that all unions or all union locals are going to be as explicitly pro-queer or pro-trans as we want them to be. But by getting involved in the labor movement and helping any organizing campaign or walking a picket line, having that cross-community solidarity and visibility is hugely important because it does help break stigma. It helps bring about a class consciousness of we both face similar types of oppression and similar types of lack, whether that's a lack of a living wage, a lack of workplace protections, a lack of equitable hours in the workplace, a lack of protection specifically around protected classes like queer people, trans people, ethnic minorities, things like that. By getting involved and by being visible, you help break that stigma. And more importantly, you help other queer and trans people like you who are working class. It doesn't mean converting everybody into an LGBT ally, but it does really mean something when you show up and say, I'm a queer or a trans person, and I'm here to help these workers because their struggles are my struggles. An injury to one is an injury to all. We might not see eye to eye on a lot of things, but it still matters. And the labor movement, as I've stressed before, does have a very rich history of queer and trans people coming to back it up, even if it was socially or culturally conservative in that area or in that time. By participating in that activism as visible queer and trans people, we help break the stigma that we are not involved in the labor movement when we very much are. We are a huge part of the heart of it, in fact. And I really want to stress that to all of our listeners as well. The Labor Hall is another place where queer and trans people get together to change the world in the ways that they want to see. Reach out to your local labor organizers. Figure out where the next picket's going to be. You know, start a union in your workplace and specifically fight for those protections that you want, whether that's the ability for your health insurance to cover any kind of medical-related transition costs, whether that's greater anti-discrimination protections for queer and trans people in the workplace and other marginalized groups as well. By getting involved, you make the changes you want to see in the world on the shop floor and in your community. Join a union. It's just as rainbow-colored as the parade. You know, and I guess in terms of the IWW, the first color of the, to borrow a phrase from the Philippine Communist Party, the first color of the rainbow is red. Join the ranks of other working people who are also trying to fight against the same forms of oppression that we face. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
And as an older person, I can strongly recommend to younger workers, think about the future. Think about a pension. Think about things that will give you security and comfort when you're older. Give you more flexibility of where to live, what to do in your retirement.
Right.
So think about the future. I was not one of those. My mother did her best to try to convince me to save money. I never was able to. Luckily, I'm surviving okay. But I could have done a lot better had I gone her advice. Save 10% of everything you earn.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that also, that's actually a really good point as well, because I think another conversation that I've noticed within queer and trans spaces as well is that we deserve to die comfortably and old and happy and surrounded by the people that we love.
Yeah.
Part of that is being able to get a pension or an equitable retirement plan. Part of that is being able to eventually phase our way out of the workforce and live comfortable lives for what years that we have left to them. Unions help do that. Unions help protect that. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
Well, sometimes people, I think workers, especially younger workers that are not at all educated about unions or labor causes, they think, well, I can have this in a pension, or I can have this more money now. I want more money now.
Right.
And that's just something that you think about as a young person. But when you're older, you would have wished that you would have had a pension and better wages,
yeah,
which is a union.
Right. And I mean,
we deserve it all.
And also, this is something that I could have touched on a little bit earlier. This also especially matters for queer and trans people of color as well, who really do face huge wage disparities, a huge lack of retirement options, if at all. They as a group, as a marginalized group, are more likely to have to work for longer, suffer under worse working conditions, face more discrimination in the workplace. You know, things like race, sex, class, sexuality, gender identity, they all blend together in how workers are helped, in how workers are suppressed and kept quiet by their employers and kept powerless. So I think that that's a very fair point to kind of touch on as well, is that, you know, these people deserve to work in a place that protects them, that pays them well,
right,
that prevents discrimination and harm against them specifically for being queer or trans or a person of color or any other form of marginalization. And on top of that, they also deserve to retire, and unions help get all of those things. You know, it's something that all queer and trans people, most queer and trans people, suffer from. We should have a second home in our labor halls. Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
And just to amplify a little bit about what you were saying about stigma and stereotype, it's just like the question of race in America. So many people knew that people of color, so many white people knew that people of color were just as good and just as moral and just as hardworking as they were, and yet they were constrained by society. If you said something like that, you know, you could be branded as a person not to be trusted. Let's put it that way. So breaking the stigma and breaking stereotypes works. It's a two-way street. if my queer brothers and sisters can feel relaxed around me, that's, to me, worth its weight in gold, you know, because it means that it opens up so many more avenues for, well, just for friendship and fun, you know, when people are not uncomfortable around each other. And so I really recommend that people take a good look. Don't think that, you know, it's a specialized or it's a, you know, it's a specialty type grievance. It's all over the world and it's all through society. And the sooner we can get rid of these racial and sexual orientation stigmata, as soon as we can get rid of that and just graduate into adult humanity, the better off the whole world will be.
The breaking of those barriers that prevent working class solidarity builds working class solidarity.
Indeed, you got it. That's precisely right.
We want to talk a little bit about some local events that are previous and upcoming to kind of keep our fellow workers informed as to what's going on in the Tacoma Pierce County area. Like I said earlier, Seattle Pride is going to be taking place this month on the weekend of the 28th through the 1st. That's Friday the 28th through July the 1st. And then Tacoma Pride is going to be taking place through the weekend of the 13th and the 14th. I believe the 13th is the actual Tacoma Pride Fest. We, the Tacoma IWW, are hoping to table. We'll try and inform our fellow workers out there as soon as possible. Some other involvements that you can get involved with as well. Sorry. Some other forms of activism that you can get involved with as well. The campus protests for Gaza are still going on. Yeah. Some of them have closed up shop due to a lack of turnout or due to severe repression by universities and by the police. Please find those local encampments and support them as best as possible. I would also encourage you to keep your eyes out coming up towards Labor Day, which is coming up later this year. I know that the Central Labor Hall here for Pierce County in Tacoma has a bunch of different events coming up, and the Tacoma IWW hopes to show up to those as well. I would also like to keep you in touch about events specifically going on here in Tacoma. Another thing that I would like to encourage our listeners to do, there are a bunch of local unions here in the Tacoma Pierce County area that could really use your help. As we mentioned earlier, the Boeing firefighters have finally reached an agreement with Boeing, so that lockout is currently off. However, the Macy's workers here at Tacoma Mall are still fighting for a fair contract. They have recently received word that something might be going on from corporate in order to try and reach an agreement, but as far as I personally have been aware, nothing conclusive has been reached yet. That union specifically is, this is Macy's Workers for Power here in South Sound through UFCW 367. I highly suggest that you reach out to them. They can really use help with people showing up to their informational pickets at local Macy's locations, specifically the one at the Tacoma Mall as well. I would reach out to UFCW 367 here in the Tacoma Pierce County area and ask how you can get involved. They're really reaching out to a bunch of other labor organizations for help with informational pickets and pressuring the company to give them a fair contract during these negotiations. Earlier in May, we went to a movie screening at the Grand Cinema, and the Macy's Workers for Power stood up afterwards and did a great speech about what they're fighting for in terms of better insurance options, better wages, better protections in the workplace for workers, and they can really use the community's support. That's the thing that they stress. They really need the wider community to be involved and to be informed. So please reach out to UFCW 367, or you can look up Macy's Workers for Power on Facebook. Other than that, the IWW here in Tacoma is also planning to hopefully table at some other local festivals as well. We're looking at the Hilltop Street Fair later this summer. We are also hoping to participate in Art on the Ave on 6th Avenue later this summer as well. We will keep our listeners and our wider social media followers informed as to whether or not we get tabling locations for that as well.
Also, yes. Porch Fest.
Also, Porch Fest as well is another event that we're currently keeping our eyes on. We're hoping to reach out to somebody in the neighborhood where Porch Fest is going to be taking place. It would be really fun to sing some union songs from the Little Red Songbook to all the people who are participating in the festival. And yeah, so please find your local Gaza encampment, find a way to support the Palestinians, reach out to your local labor unions, ask them if there's a picket that you can attend, or if there's a campaign that you can help support just by spreading the word. You're already doing a great amount of help. Yes?
And on the Gaza issue, I'd like to point out that don't believe the canard that anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are synonymous, that they're the same. They're not. There are a lot of Jewish people and there are a lot of people in politics who are reluctant to speak out against what's happening in Gaza simply because they don't want to face the wrath of their own organizations or their own co-religionists or whatever. But please, please don't allow the propaganda to, you know, stop you from participating in what is essentially just a humanistic movement for, you know, a ceasefire and to stop all the bloodshed.
Thank you, fellow worker Gordon.
The labor movement, the folks who brought you The Weeknd.
Thank you.
Think about that.
It's a wrap. I like that.
Think about that. That's really true.
It is. And things like health insurance and things like, you know, minimum wage.
Alrighty. Once again, this has been a production of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. If you or a fellow worker near you would like to get a union in their workplace and begin the organizing process, you can feel free to reach out to the Tacoma IWW on Facebook or on Instagram. We have local delegates and organizers who are able to help you get a union set up in the place where you work so that you can get better wages, hours, and conditions to fight back against the tyranny of the boss. We would also like to thank our fellow distributors for this radio program, specifically 101.9 KTAH, that's Radio Tacoma, 95.3 KTQA, that's also based here in Tacoma, and 94.9 KZAX, KZAX, all the way up in Bellingham. We want to thank all of our fellow workers for tuning in and listening. Solidarity.
Solidarity.
Solidarity.